Hi, my name is Ophélie, and you're listening to the Mama Activist Podcast, a podcast where we explore topics ranging from social justice, culture, politics, and news through deep conversation with myself, activists, humanitarians, and everyday people trying to make a difference. It's a space where we are willing to learn, grow, and be challenged collectively while highlighting activists doing amazing things in the world. From hearing new perspectives to learning new things, we are pushing for a better world, fighting for our liberation and reclaiming our power. So tune in and be a part of the movement. Nina and Douglas' journey, a journey that I came across in 2020 when I was working in Greece supporting Black asylum seekers and Black refugees. Nina and Douglas' story is one of the most sad, the saddest story I have come across since I started my advocacy journey. It's one of the stories that I documented in 2020 that really, you know, it shook my whole world in terms of everything I have done as an advocate, the way I have been supporting people. It tells a clear story of how bad Europe is failing Black asylum seekers and how its institutions are sitting back comfortably in the face of people's pain as well. So it's a personal story, but it's also a story that tells me a lot about our system and the immigration system in particular. And it's also a story that shows the reality of how just being an asylum seeker is a health risk in itself and can put you and your whole family at risk. So I met Nina and Douglas in 2020, like I was saying, in Lesvos Island, in Mytilene exactly. Mytilene is a small village in Lesvos Island. Lesvos Island is quite a big island, and so about 20 minutes away from Mytilene, you had the largest refugee camp in Europe, Moria Camp, the very infamous Moria Camp. And so after having been working in Athens, the capital, for almost 2 years, and having met a lot of people who I supported who came from that refugee camp, I thought that it was time for me to go to go there, you know. And this is why I ended up going to Lesbos in 2020. So I had a friend already who was living there. We worked together through an organization which I was working for when I was in Athens, and so we got on well, we stayed in touch after I left the organization. And so when I was going to the island, I contacted her, and first I was kind of like overseeing her project, trying to support her. She was managing women's shelter in Lesbos, taking women from all different backgrounds that came from they all came from the camp, most of them, and they came from very violent background as well. So those women were survivors. They were also victims of so much, you know. So it was quite interesting. Well, interesting is not the right word, but to start going to Lesbos and supporting a project like this, you know, it was really eye-opening, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Eye-opening in a way that it really showed me what the reality, like another reality, you know, like those women, amazing women, most of them were mothers as well, living in a shelter on this island, coming from this camp, coming from all the different backgrounds. Some are, you know, they were fleeing war, some were fleeing persecution, conflict, like coming from very all different backgrounds, but all kind of like tragic background. And to get to know them as women, as human, and some as sisters was beautiful, because it really is not just about having compassion and showing empathy towards people, is also seeing yourself in them. And so through my work, if there's one thing that I try to do when I talk about asylum seekers and refugees, is to humanize them. You know, they are not just numbers, they are not just a world refugee or asylum seekers, they are actual people. And this is one of the things that I aim to do through my work, to humanize those faces, you know, the people that we hear, like migrants, first migrant, blah blah blah, and the way that the Western media is talking about them is so negative. It's creating such a damaging narrative surrounding them, you know, it's not giving them a chance, and it's focusing on their arrival as well, like, you know, the fact that they came here and they are not from here, but it's not really focusing on or highlighting the reasons that made them flee in the first place. So, you know, Western media is not to trust, and yes, so humanizing them, putting faces in front of numbers, is really one of my aims through my work. But and it's going through those experiences as well that remind me of that. But yes, so going back to how I first came to the island, this is what took me to the island, and this is what I was doing first. And so my friend who was managing the women's shelter, she told me about the Black community in Lesbos from the camp that she was also trying to support. And she told me about some of the issues that she was aware of, and she's white, but she's trying her best to be an ally. And so straight away, when I told her I was coming and I landed, she told me about this man who was stabbed in the camp and who was in the hospital, and that the hospital wanted to let go of him. So this man is Douglas. So Douglas' experience illustrates the violence, the severe abuse and neglect of which the Greek and wider European system is responsible. And so one of the first things that I did when I arrived in Lesbos was to go and meet Douglas. And I had no idea that I would be involved in their journey, that I would get to have to support them, but I did. And it started the minute I saw him. So when I saw Douglas, you know, I saw one of my brother. I immediately, like, felt connected to him in a way that, you know, I could identify myself to him. You know, like, our blackness was there. There was this sense of, like, community of, like, black family. So I embraced him straight away. I felt... And obviously, again, I am a very compassionate and empathic person who is fighting for black liberation. So seeing one of my brother on the opposite of being free, of being in an hospital bed, having been stabbed a couple of times in a very unsafe space because you came here looking for safety, you know, is the opposite of being liberated. So... like, I always have to help in those situations, you know, because this is what community is about as well for me, you know, and helping my brother is helping myself as well, because I believe that I really truly have that sense of community, like, we are one in Ubuntu. I am because you are. That's an African proverb. And so I went to the hospital. He was there lying on his bed. He was severely wounded. He was very weak as well. He could barely move. Chloe, my friend, was trying her best to come and see him, even though she had like 1,000 other responsibilities on top of having to look after a woman's shelter, a very vulnerable woman. And so, you know, she kind of like introduced me to him, and then, you know, she had to go. So that connection that happened immediately. It was really like, for me, like I felt like he was my brother and that I had to do something because he was my brother, you know. And now, right now, I'm talking about my blood brothers, and if in that situation, I would have done the exact same thing for them as well, you know. And this is how I felt. But so yes, the hospital did not want to keep him. He had been in the hospital, in Mytilini hospital, for over a week when I met him in the hospital bed, and the hospital did not want to keep him. But because he came from the camp, and so imagine a large refugee camp, a big refugee camp that almost feels like a small village, a small city, because it was so big. So you just got stabbed there. He's living in a tent, you know. There is no correct infrastructure. There is, in terms of like sanitary, there is nothing. It's just tents, people sleeping in tents, having to like put up with the horrible condition, sleeping on the floor. There is no bed. There is no space for bed. There is no shower. There is no toilet, and the few toilet that there are, because they are like outside a festival toilet, you know, is very unsafe. So for someone who was severely wounded, who got stabbed in that camp as well, in that refugee camp, and who got stabbed because he was trying to, because of a telephone, a mobile phone. So while sitting down with his friends, his wife's phone was stolen from right out of his hands as he was just literally minding his own business. And as he attempted to retrieve his wife's phone from the man who had just robbed him, another man quickly approached, pulled out a knife and stabbed him a couple of times. And then when he tried to defend himself against the attacker, he was outnumbered. Like three other men came and surrounded him, and they tried to stab him again. So, you know, he had just been stabbed a couple of times. He was severely wounded, but he managed to escape and run through like a forest, where he was chased up by the group of men who had just stabbed him, stolen his wife's phone. But he kept running until he was able to find some help. And then he told me about how he had to wait like 30 minutes. He was bleeding. There is, I saw videos of him on the floor, people screaming around him, trying to call the police, trying to call the ambulance. You know, and if you see the video, you might have thought that he was dead or he was going to die, you know. But yes, the ambulance took about 30 minutes to find him. So at this point, he was already bleeding. He was slipping in and out of consciousness. He had to be kept awake by the people around. And yeah, it was horrible, you know. How scary for you as well, you know. You came here to Europe thinking that you would have so much better opportunities, that your life will be better, like that you will be safer, and that your integration will be somehow okay. That it would have to be okay because there is no other choice, you know. Like you flee your country, everything you know, to then find yourself in a refugee camp, very unsafe because of the hostility that's created, and that is again due to, for me, it's Europe's foot, you know. They are the one that are creating this hostile environment where people are suffering, and that are creating and like pushing for that violence. And so back to Douglas being in the, so he told me the story, and so there was no way that he could go back to the camp, you know. There is no ways. But then the hospital just wouldn't hear it because they had to deal with so many other people and other cases. But obviously, how can you leave a man who just got stabbed go back to into a a refugee camp where the like it's unsafe, there's so much hostility, there is no it's disgusting. It's disgusting. Like it was yeah. No way, you know. So the issue was then to find an accommodation for him in on the island, in the context of like refugee crisis. You have organization that works with the state, and they provide accommodation for refugees. You have social workers from through the UNHCR or through again like local authorities that help with getting accommodation or looking at cases and applying for asylum. They support you through that journey, through that like legalizing, like being legalized and legalizing your situation, regulating your situation. But there was no social worker on his case because obviously the incident had just happened, and you know, before they were still in the process of like doing their interview, I think they just had done their interview and were waiting for their asylum claim, but they just didn't have an a social worker who was very active, and after they were assigned a social worker who was able to find better accommodation. But for him to find that accommodation, you know, my friend and I, like especially her, she had to make a couple of calls. She had to fight me. I had to fight with the doctors. I had to persuade them to allow our friend to stay in the hospital for a couple of days longer. And every day was a struggle. And you know, it was always like I had to do some convincing, a lot of convincing for them to let him out. For them to let him in, to let him stay longer, not let him out. It was the opposite. So yeah, it was not easy at all for him. And this is the circumstances in which I met Douglas. And then, so after all of those challenges, he was able to get an accommodation, and he was moved into the accommodation that was far from everything. There was no transport to it, but that's another issue. So really for me, again, Douglas' experience, it illustrates the violence, the severe abuse, the neglect, of which, again, the Greek and wider European system is responsible. You know, the violence was clear. He got stabbed. And then, you know, for the authorities, on the island, because of the number of people, because for the institution as well, because of the situation, they didn't see people as people. They just saw people as number. They dehumanize people in front of them to an extent that leads to severe neglect. Like they will leave them to die if there is no one to advocate for them, and if they are not capable of advocating for themselves. And even if they do advocate for themselves, they are not being heard. When we give them platform, you know, when we make space, their institutions are just not willing to hear them, you know. So most of the time, it does require other people advocating on their behalf, or, you know, I don't know, it's just dehumanizing. It's a whole process that is dehumanizing. It's neglect, and it's Europe, the European system, and the Greek system that are responsible. But more than Greece is Europe, because of the way that they've closed their barriers and the thing that they will do to stop people from coming, to stop people from integrating, and from, you know, it's underneath is lying this willingness from the West to maintain white supremacy. And the consequences of it, the things that comes from white supremacy, is also all that violence, that justification of black people suffering, because it's allowing white people to thrive almost, you know. That's what white supremacy is also justifying. And the fact that just supremacy is still dominating nowadays is also an issue, because it's clearly it's clearly creating violence. It's we are losing our brothers and sisters at the end of that, you know. So there is two sides of the same coins, and one side of it that we don't really understand, but us also uplifting that white supremacy is also causing that violence. But again, the European system, I blame them for that, and the fact that they are closing their borders and just making it impossible for people of color to come. So they are taking from people of color, they are taking from black people, but then when black people are coming here, they have no space for them. So Douglas got to his apartment finally. He got an infection after, but his health did get better after a couple of months. But so Douglas' wife, Nina, I met her during my second visit to Douglas in the hospital. And she was pregnant. Nina's pregnancy journey and the birth of her daughter, Ria Both, tell us about the tragic narrative of a broken and discriminatory immigration system that is breaking families apart, enduring pregnant women, their children, and it's creating trauma. Nina was about 6 months pregnant at the time. She was looking after Douglas. She was taking care of him. She was going up and down when the lift wasn't available. She would take public transports, get to wherever she needed to go to make sure that her husband was okay and that he was recovering well. But she was also having issues. I had to go with her to Médecins Sans Frontières, who were Doctor Without Borders, who were providing medical assistance in the park. They had like a little corner where you could queue and you could be viewed by a doctor, a volunteer doctor. So Nina wasn't feeling all right. And I think that when we were at the hospital, she mentioned that she's been bleeding or something like this. So they advised that she saw someone. So we went to see someone. We had to queue and we met this woman from Spain. I had to translate from Nina, but Nina was having a normal bleeding. She was doing too much. She had a urine infection. Like she was also experiencing being pregnant and living in the camp while her husband had just been stabbed. So she was also feeling very, very unsafe, not just because of the living situation, but because of what had just happened to them and because she was pregnant. But both their stories speak to and highlight the many levels and layers of violence inflicted upon the refugee population as a result of European policies on immigration. Its political game and institutional racism prevailing through the system. Nina, on the night of the 3rd of August, when she was 7 months pregnant, Nina was admitted to the hospital. Baby had been kicking so much, her placenta had broken open. The couples, they were able to stay together during the night. Douglas was able to accompany her to the hospital, and they were told during the night that the next morning Nina would have to be transferred to Athens. And the next morning, the same morning, Douglas had to go to the camp to get his Ausweis, so his papers, to renew his asylum card, Ausweis. And he couldn't miss it, because if you missed it, it's again to have an appointment to do this is just going to be so long. So he had to go take it. So his plan was to go very quick, very early, get his Ausweis, and then get some clothes for them to be transferred to Athens, because they were supposed to transfer Douglas, his wife. You know, they came here, they asked for asylum together, so their case is together. So they told them that they would be transferred to Athens together, because the baby is at risk now and she needed to give birth, even though it was very early still in her pregnancy, well, not too early. So Douglas called me. We took him to the camp. We got his Ausweis. We took him to his apartment. We got his we got his stuff, and Nina was still at the hospital. We got back to the hospital, and Nina is not there anymore. At first, I think Douglas didn't know how to react, but you could see in his face that he was panicking, but he was trying to keep calm. I was angry. I was angry because, like, how could they do this, you know? And then the doctors that were with Nina, they just refused to talk to us or to tell us anything. They racial profiled us straight away because we were both black. So it was like, you know, we're both refugees, asylum seekers. We know nothing. We mean nothing. So to find someone who would actually have a discussion with us was very challenging. It took a lot of arguing. It took me crying. Douglas having to calm me down. Douglas, you know, for us to find out the name of the area in which she was staying. And that's all we got. And we didn't know. We were not able to find out whether or not she had given birth already, or if the baby was okay, if she was okay. Nothing. So Douglas, again, just for you to realize, guys, the violence. So Douglas had just been stabbed, and it was this happened on the night of August the 3rd, 2020, and 1 month before, on the 6th of July, Douglas got attacked and stabbed a couple of times. So he was still recovering from it. A month later, his wife is taking. She has no phone, nothing with her. So I had to call hospitals in the area. I had to call maybe 3 hospitals before I found out where she was staying. And then nobody on the phone would was speaking English properly, so they couldn't really... we knew Nina was there, but I needed some Greek speaker to help me translate everything that they were telling us. So the hospital... Just to go back to the hospital was just being very racist. I just want to say that. And now, fast forward, I asked one of my best friends who spoke many languages, and one of the languages is Greek, and he was able to speak to Nina and to find out that no, she had not given birth, but she was about to give birth, and that she was still weak. And then me and another friend, me and the friend who was managing the community center, the woman shelter, sorry, we went to Athens. We took the ferry, 11 hours ferry, and then we drove 4 hours to where she was staying. So they didn't send her to Athens at all. So they send her in the middle of nowhere, but we went to her. It took us about 20 hours, but we went to her and we were able to give her a phone so that she could speak. She could speak with her husband, and that was just after she had given birth. Sorry, so she had given birth finally, but they took the baby away from her, and because of COVID, they wouldn't let her see her baby. So for about 4 months, she was separated from the baby she had just given birth to, and for about 6 to 7 months, Douglas was separated from his family. So Nina had experienced everything, and when she was in the hospital, she was isolated from her baby and from everybody else. And her daughter Ria, both Ophelia Mulamba, was born on August the 14th. And yes, they gave her my name. They gave the little girl my first name, Ophelia. But yes, just a minute after giving birth, her baby was taken from her. And only 3 days later, after she's given birth, I was able to speak with Nina's gynecologist over the phone when Nina was still in the hospital, and she was allowed to briefly see her daughter again. So her baby was separated from her from the minute she was... She gave birth. Her husband was still in Lesbos Island, like so far away, still recovering from being stabbed. And her daughter was born prematurely, and she needed to stay in the hospital for proper medical care. So the hospital actually wanted Nina to be transferred back to the island. So we also had to have discussions with Nina, social worker, so that they would find an accommodation for her in the town. You know, I even had to call up a couple of people. We were trying to find ways that she could stay, you know. And they say that she would be separated from her child for up to 3 months. But to be honest, I don't think that they would have done the effort to reunite them. And this is also something that happens a lot in Greece. Asylum seekers, refugees, migrants being separated from their children. So to make sure this will not happen, Douglas and I, we spoke with a number of social workers to find a place where Nina could stay. And baby Ria, but she was in a critical condition, you know. She spent her first 2 weeks in a coma on a ventilator for over a month. She suffered from a blood infection, and then when that got better, she had issues with her eyes. And on August 17, 5 days after the pregnancy, Nina was transferred to a woman's house about 20 minutes from the hospital, and there nobody again could speak French. And during this extremely traumatic time, she had no one to talk to, and so this is when we went to her, got her phone, and she told us about how it's been for her, and she was mentally suffering. She had to process this experience alone, away from her husband, her child, or anyone who could speak her language. You know, the system had failed her on every level and made her even more vulnerable and traumatized after the traumatizing journey that she had to go through to come here. The first thing that I did when I saw her, I hugged her. And yeah, their story didn't end there, you know. That's when I got to support them. So, like, the end of the story was really to make sure that they were speaking. They got reunited a couple of months after I had already left the island myself. But I was able to see them last month. And that, I guess, earlier I was talking about the beauty of their journey, and I guess that there is beauty in it that I can see, but for a while I was seeing the hurt, the violence, the neglect, and I see this again. But in meeting them again in Paris, in France, there was so much beauty in it after everything that they've been through, after the experience that we went through together, painful, traumatizing experience. We were able to meet at my family's house in Paris, France. My mom was celebrating her 54th birthday. It was very intimate. And they joined us, they met my family, and they thanked me. You know, I met Ria, but I saw her as a baby. No, actually, I was there, sorry, when they got reunited. So that was actually beautiful. I was there. I saw them. I met Rhea, but it was beautiful. But yes, so it was also very beautiful to see them in France, meet them, meeting my family, my parents. And, you know, Douglas is so much bigger now. Nina was so beautiful. They were all matching. They were wearing matching jackets. Rhea Bot is 3 years. You know, she was playing with my uncles, playing with my brother, my mom, my aunties. She had the food, Nina had the food my mom made, and so for me, it was a very beautiful moment, a very intimate moment, you know, of reconnecting with people that I had helped, who were not only people I helped, but who are my brothers and my sister, and to see them thrive after seeing them endure everything that they had to endure. In the end of a broken system, to see them thrive and do better, to see their resilience and my own. It was beautiful to see the way that my family also was open to make safes for them so easy, you know. That divine, natural sense of community that you find amongst Black people that was there as well. it was such a beautiful moment, and I'm very grateful for it. And also, this is why I do the work that I do, you know, to make sure that we are all safe. Like, this path of liberation is my own as much as it is yours. It is yours. It is truly yours, and it is truly mine. We truly deserve to be free, and freedom, liberation for me means joy, you know. There is this natural joy that we inherit just from being, that we are worth just because we are, and we should all have access to it. We should all. Anyway, that for this episode. For anyone who's heard Nina and Douglas' story and who wants to make sure that they are not contributing to that, you know, to that violence, well, question the things that you are doing in the society, in today's society, because, you know, it starts with, like, small things, you know. We do feel powerless, but in reality, as individuals living in a collective, in community, living in today's society, we do have power. We do have power. It's like, just reclaim your own.